Thank you very much for that introduction, Steve. It's a great honor to be with you and to associate with many colleagues in addressing this conference. I've got the easy task. I'm going to introduce some of the ideas and then leave it to the experts to develop them. Of course, every lecturer has a biography, and it would be useful to you to know a little bit, at least, of where I'm coming from in my thinking. I come from Northern Ireland, which isn't always the best advertisement for the Christian faith. But my parents were very unusual. They were Christian without being sectarian. And secondly, they allowed me to think. So I grew up to think of Christianity as intellectually, massively stimulating. It didn't occur to me till much later that some people found it otherwise. And so I was introduced to the big ideas when I was 12 or 13 years old and started to read many of the books that normally are only read when you get to university. I ended up in Cambridge, which you may have heard of. Even though I'm now in Oxford, it's wonderful to be able to win the boat race every year. And in my first week as a student, something happened that marked my life. A student said to me at dinner, rather too loudly, he said, "Do you believe in God?" And then he said, "Oh, sorry, you're Irish, I shouldn't have asked you that question. You all believe in God and you fight about it." Now, of course, I'd heard that many times before, but somehow it suddenly struck me that here was a real opportunity in Cambridge to get to know people that did not share my worldview. And so I deliberately, in week one of my undergraduate career, sought out someone who did not share my worldview. And I've been doing it ever since. And my attitude is simply to try to befriend people, to get to know what makes them tick. And what I've discovered is the more I am vulnerable with my own faith in God, the more that faith has grown stronger, as I've discovered that it answers the very big questions. You know, our title is Genesis and Genetics, and this student really felt that I believed in Genesis because of Irish genetics, if you get the reference. And I find it very difficult to live that down. But let's get into our topic. The first myth we need to explode is the notion that there is a warfare between science and faith in God. That is demonstrably false. Last year's Nobel Prize for Physics was won by a Scotsman, Peter Higgs. A few years ago, it was won by a North American, William Phillips. The difference between them is not their physics. They're both Nobel Prize winners. The difference between them is that Peter Higgs is an atheist and Bill Phillips a Christian. And that ought to be enough to show us that the problem lies much deeper. You see, if it were true that science and faith in God were essentially at war, you wouldn't have a Bill Phillips. So what I'm going to suggest to you is there's a real conflict, but it is not at the level of science and faith in God. It is a worldview conflict involving two fundamentally opposed explanations of ultimate reality. And perhaps the best way to see that is to go back to ancient Greece, where you had on the one hand the atomists, Democritus and Leucippus, brilliant men with fundamental ideas that last until today, who believed that reality consisted ultimately of atoms and empty space. And as the atoms cascaded through empty space, they coalesced to form galaxies and stars and worlds and life and so on. And for them, ultimate reality was, as we would say today, mass energy. There was no transcendence, there was no God. They are the fathers of materialism. But then at the same time, there were people like my intellectual hero Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, who believed that there was transcendence, there were the gods, or there was God. And barreling up through the centuries into the contemporary Western Academy, you have those two diametrically opposed worldviews. Theism on the one side, and materialism stroke naturalism on the other side. And the point to grasp is There are scientists on both sides of that divide. So the real question I think we address in this conference is this: which way does science point? Does it point, as Dawkins and others claim, towards atheism? Or does it point to theism, or does it point nowhere? Now, my basic axiom as a Christian is that the universe is not neutral in its communication of God. Romans 1 says in verse 19, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." The view of Romans is that the evidence of the created universe is so powerful that in itself constitutes people as without excuse. Now, there's something very important in this text. What Paul says is his invisible attributes are perceived. He doesn't say they're proved. And there's a reason for that, of course, because the word proof in English has at least two meanings, and they get constantly confused. There is the rigorous sense of proof that only exists in my field of pure mathematics, where a proof is a series of logical deductions from a set of accepted axioms leading to a certain result based on that process. You do not get that kind of proof in any other science or in any other part of life. That does not, of course, mean that asking for evidence without reasonable doubt produces nothing. I cannot prove logically to you that my wife, who's been with me for the last 46 years, loves me. I can't prove that mathematically, but I'd stake my life on it, because there's evidence for it. So what we're going to be talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is not proof in the strict mathematical sense. It's evidence, pointers, indicators. Where does the weight of the argument lie? And so what I want to give to you in order to encourage you to engage in this debate, some of what I consider to be the basic ideas that can be, firstly, easily understood, and secondly, easily communicated into our culture. So I'm going to draw evidence from several areas. Firstly, from the history of science. Secondly, from the philosophy of science. And probably not at all from the results of science. But we shall see how far we go. There will be others who will do that subsequently. So let's take the history of science and the fact that modern science exploded in the 16th and 17th centuries under Galileo and Kepler and Newton and so on. They were all believers in God. And Alfred North Whitehead, commenting on this, said that Europe in 1500 knew less than Archimedes, who died in 212 BC, and yet by 1700, Newton's Principia Mathematica had been written. Why was that? Here's his answer. It must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God, conceived as with the personal energy of Jehovah, the rationality of a Greek philosopher. The impress on the European mind arising from the unquestioned faith of science. Putting it more succinctly, C.S. Lewis wrote this: men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. Now that, to my mind, is fascinating. This is known variously as Merton's thesis, Whitehead's thesis, and so on, and is generally agreed among philosophers of science with certain nuances. The point is this, that far from hindering science, Christian belief was the motor that drove it. So I'm not remotely embarrassed to be both a scientist and a Christian, since arguably Christianity gave me my subject. Now, the irony in this is this, that it is the Christian faith in God that was the basis for the faith every scientist needs to do their science. One of the misleading ideas in our culture is that you've got faith over there and science over there, because faith has been redefined in our culture as a religious concept, which means believing where there's no evidence. That is doubly and dangerously false. Because, first of all, I speak as a Christian, the Christian faith is not based on no evidence. It's not blind faith in that sense. John's Gospel makes that clear. Jesus did many other things, he says, that are not written in this book, but these are written in order that you might believe. Here is the evidence. If Christianity were not evidence-based, then we'd need to get rid of the New Testament, because it claims to be evidence. That's the one side. But the redefinition of faith has meant, and this is very dangerous, that people do not realize that faith is involved in science and indeed in any worldview activity. I debated Peter Singer of Princeton in Melbourne, and it illustrates it brilliantly. I admitted to the audience, as I always do, that I come from a Christian background. And he said, well, that's of course my biggest objection to religion. People remain in the faith in which they're brought up. So when I got the chance to speak, I said, Peter, I'm sure the audience would love to know about your parents. Were they atheists? And he said, yes, they were. So I said, so you've remained in the faith in which you were brought up. Oh, but he said, it isn't a faith. Oh, I said, Peter, I'm very sorry. I was under the impression you believed it. Now, you see, that spat is very revealing. Twitter space, whatever that is. It went viral, because here's a world-class philosopher that doesn't realize that his worldview is a belief system. And we need to grasp that. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to be very clear that faith is being taught at every university and school in this country and in Western Europe, but it isn't faith in God. And we need, I think, to give up the use of faith as exclusively a religious term, and get it back to where it belongs. Faith means trust, belief. And you've got to add to it, in what? And as a scientist, I believe, as I've come to talk about in a moment or two, in the rational intelligibility of the universe. As a Christian, I believe in God. And it's on each side a question of faith. And we mustn't sell the past to the atheists by agreeing with their definitions. So, the odd thing now is we face Isaac Newton in Cambridge in the 17th century believing in God, and Stephen Hawking in the 20th century, the 21st, in the same chair at Cambridge, saying you've got to choose between science and God. How is that possible? And I want to help those of you, especially young people, to get into this, because you'll discover that in order to understand the debate, you don't need to know a lot of science. It's very helpful to know some science. And you learn that from the experts as you listen to them. But most of the arguments have to do with the way in which science is misunderstood and misused. And I'm going to illustrate that. Why is it, here's our question, that Stephen Hawking insists we choose between science and God when Newton didn't? And it's not just a passage of time. Well, the first thing is, it's confusion about the nature of God. I was accused in debates in the Netherlands a few weeks ago of believing in a God who was like Santa Claus, but I easily put that right with the audience, because I simply asked him, who of you as an adult came to believe in Santa Claus? And I pointed out I'd known hundreds of people as adults come to believe in God. It is idiotic and puerile to compare belief in God with belief in Santa Claus. And secondly, the argument of Freud on which that's based is a two-edged sword. As Manfred Lutz, the leading psychiatrist in Germany, has pointed out in a delightful book called Eine kleine Geschichte des Größten. It hasn't come into English yet. It's a short history of the Great One. And he points out, if there is no God, Freud gives you a brilliant argument to think that belief is simply, religion is simply wish fulfillment if there is no God. Of course, he said if there is a God, the very same argument shows you that atheism is a wish fulfillment. The desire never have to meet God. And then he delivers the bottom line. As a psychiatrist, he said, whether there's a God or not, Freud, Jung, and Frankl cannot help you at all. You'll have to look elsewhere. And it's illustrated beautifully by Stephen Hawking, who was interviewed by the Times in Britain, and he was asked, what do you think of religion? And he said, it's a fairy story for people who are afraid of the dark. And they asked me to comment, and I said, well, atheism is a fairy story for people afraid of the light. You shouldn't clap, you know, because if you'd followed my previous argument, you'll see those don't mean anything or prove anything. But the point is to grasp that these arguments are often double-edged. And it's worth always investigating when you meet an argument to see if you can actually turn it around. Now, the second confusion about the nature of God, the first one was the delusion, is that the God that Christians believe in is like an ancient Greek god of thunder. You know, the kind of god that they were terrified of. And then you do a bit of atmospheric physics at Caltech and that god disappears. A god of the gaps. And you'll see that in the way they argue. I did an Oxford debate with Michael Shermer, editor of Skeptic magazine, an Oxford professor of philosophy, and Richard Dawkins, he came, but he didn't debate. So they were all on the other side. So Michael Shermer, looking at me, said, you are an atheist. With respect to Zeus and Wotan and Baal, he went through a whole boring list. And he says, with a great grin on his face, we just go one God more. And I thought, how utterly simplistic and naive. You see, he thinks that I believe in a God that's in the list of Greek gods. That's a God of the gaps. A God who is the X. I can't explain it, therefore God did it, but a bit more science will remove him. That shows he knows nothing about ancient Near Eastern gods. Because the thing about them, as Werner Jaeger, one of the top experts in Oxford, has written, is the gods of the ancient Near East, without exception, are descended from the heavens and the earth. The ancient Near Eastern cultures had theogonies, not simply cosmogonies. The genesis of their gods, and their gods came from the primitive material of the universe. That's fascinating when you compare it with what some contemporary physicists believe. And we'll come to that a little bit later. But then he said this, the God of the Bible created the heavens and the earth. That means he's in a different category. And I used to wonder, why is it that Hawking, our question, forces this decision between God and science, and suddenly it was clear to me. It's because he thinks that I believe in a God of the gaps. Now follow me. If you think that God is simply some sort of explanation for what we cannot yet scientifically explain, of course you have to choose between God and science, because that is the way you've defined God. Have you got it? You see, if you define God in opposition to science, of course you'll have to choose between the two. So it is a profound, endemic confusion about the nature of God that's causing the difficulty. So we have the task of explaining that the God of the Bible is not the God of the gaps, he's the God of the whole show. The bits we do understand and the bits we don't. And indeed, when you think of Isaac Newton, when he got his law of gravity, he didn't say, I've got a law of gravity, I don't need God. No, what did he say? Well, he wrote the Principia Mathematica, expressing in it the hope that it would help a thinking person to believe in a deity. In other words, the more he understood of the universe, the more he worshipped the God who did it that way. And that's sheer simple logic. The more I understand of engineering, the more I can admire space shuttle. The more I understand of art, the more I can admire the genius of a Rembrandt, not the less. And the more I know of the universe, the more I can admire the God that did it that way. Now, these things are simple, but they are very important, because it's very easy to give the unconscious impression that you believe in that kind of God of the gaps. We need to stand against it, because it completely emasculates the arguments that are being used against us. But of course, there's a second thing. There's confusion about the nature of scientific explanation. Confusion about the nature of God, confusion about the nature of scientific explanation. And that has led to scientism. The idea that science is the only way to truth. That's a very dangerous notion because it ends up convincing people that science is coextensive with rationality. Now that's nonsense, of course. Otherwise half the departments in your university and every other one would have to close. And Bertrand Russell was a great philosopher, but he made a very interesting statement. He said, "What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know." Well, his logic departed him then, didn't it? Because that statement is not a statement of science. What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. So since it's not a statement of science, if science is the only way to truth, you cannot know it. So if it's true, it's false. I know it's a bit late in the day for logic, but you just have to put up with some of it from me, I'm afraid. That is wild talk. Sir Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize, was far wiser when he said that science cannot answer the simple questions of a child. Where do I come from? Where am I going? And it was George Ellis. I'm beginning to call scientism scientific fundamentalism because it rings much, much clearer. And George Ellis uses the term, I was interested to discover, he's a cosmologist, and he says this happens when a partial truth is proclaimed as the whole truth. Only one viewpoint is allowed. All others are false. That is scientism. That is scientific fundamentalism. But when you begin to ask, what is scientific explanation? Indeed, what is science? You discover that's not an easy question to answer. It used to be thought by some people that science were totally dispassionate and independent and so on and so forth. Now, that's gone. Every scientist is a human being who brings her perspective, his worldview to their science. And most of us, I suppose, in science are critical realists. That is, we believe there's a truth out there that can be accessed, at least in part. But we only partially access it. We get nearer to the truth. Einstein is nearer than Newton, but we may be able to go further and come closer to that truth. But when you ask, what does it mean to say that science explains? Well, one response is to say it explains in terms of materials, of laws and mechanisms. But let me concretize that. What does the law of gravity explain? Now, I can remember the day it dawned on me that the law of gravity does not explain gravity. It doesn't tell you what gravity is. Nobody knows what gravity is. If you don't accept that, read Richard Feynman. You see, the law of gravity is a mathematical law that enables you to make brilliant predictions and calculations. But even Newton realized, non fingo hypothesi, I do not feign hypotheses. That is, I'm not telling you what gravity is. And it was Wittgenstein who saw this the clearest. He said, the greatest deception of modernism is the idea that the laws of nature explain to the world to us when all they do is to describe structural regularities. So when people say science explains, we've got to ask them what they mean by explanation. Now let me take a much simpler thing. Why is a kettle boiling? Well, it's boiling because heat energy is being applied from a Bunsen burner. It's reaching 100 degrees centigrade. The molecules are vibrating very fast. They're beginning to throw off steam and so on. Nonsense. It's boiling because I want a cup of tea. I'm glad you're laughing because it means you see the difference between a scientific explanation and a personal or agent explanation. It's so obvious. I talk to many kids in schools. They see it immediately. And God is not the same kind of explanation as science. God is an agent explanation. Science gives us the mechanisms and the laws. And I sometimes say to children, I say, look, suppose we got a Ford motor car here. I'm going to offer you two explanations for it. One is the law of internal combustion and automobile engineering. The other is Henry Ford. Will you please choose? And the kids all laugh. They say, but sir, you need both. Why can't Dawkins see that? It's so simple. Henry Ford does not compete, conflict with the law of internal combustion as an explanation for the car. He complements that explanation. He's a different kind of explanation. Those two kinds of explanations don't threaten one another. And the interesting thing is you need both of them for a fuller explanation. And it's the same with the universe. God isn't competing with the law of gravity or the laws of quantum mechanics or the laws of the standard model of physics. God is the reason why there are any explanations at all in terms of science, because he's the creator who causes it to be and who supports it in being. They're different kinds of explanation. And you see this, Lawrence Krauss, with whom I've engaged several times. He's an interesting person to engage with. It's a bit more like quantum entanglement, I think, when you get to grips with him. But anyway, he wrote, the Higgs boson is arguably more important than God. Well, I wrote a little article about that. And I said, arguably more important than God for what? If you're teaching particle physics to students, well, then, of course, the Higgs boson is more important than God. But if you're answering the question, why there is a universe at all in which particle physics can be done, then God is much more important than the Higgs boson. And so I concluded my article in the newspaper, and the Times published it, I was glad to say. I said at the end, what are we going to say about the Higgs boson? Well, I said, Higgs predicted it, CERN found it, and God invented it. We celebrate the first two, what about the third? You see, it's confusion about levels of explanation. Now, of course, I'm very well aware that the major objection to this is going to come from Richard Dawkins. Look, just hang on a bit in this matter of explanations, because you're making a vast mistake. If you invoke God as an explanation at any level, that's not possible for two reasons. The first is, if you claim that God created the universe, you'll have to logically ask who created God. And then you'll have to say who created the creator that created the creator and so on, ad nauseam and ad absurdum. And so the whole thing's absurd. Let's forget God and go to playing football and doing something sensible. But you see, that's no good, ladies and gentlemen. That is the heart of the God delusion, which staggered me when I saw it. I used to get things like that in Russia, where I spent a lot of time, from materialists who believed the universe was eternal and would raise these questions, but not in Oxford. But yet I find it in the God delusion. Who created God? Let's analyze it. A little bit more logic, part two. Who created or what created X? That statement, that question, has an assumption built in that's not always apparent. It's simply that X is created. If you ask who created X, you're assuming X is created. So what if X wasn't created? Well, the question doesn't apply, of course. So this question collapses if God is, as the Bible claims him to be, an uncreated God, an eternal God. So what's Dawkins' difficulty? Is it the difficulty with the concept of something eternal, or is it more the difficulty with someone eternal? I don't know whether many of you have seen the film, God is Not Dead. How many people have seen that film? Well, you'll have seen in the classroom scene in the first one, a girl interrupts the student and raises this question, who created the creator? And the answer is given as taken from my book, and I give it to Dawkins. If you think that question is meaningful, let me face you with it. You believe the universe created you. Okay, who created your creator? I'm still waiting for the answer from Dawkins, and I've waited 7 years now. You see, created gods are a delusion. And if he'd written a book called The Created Gods Delusion, nobody would have bought it. So the question falls. Behind it, there's a serious philosophical issue. And that is the question of what constitutes ultimate reality. Do the questions go back and back and back, or do they stop? And for most people, they stop on both sides of the argument. With me, they stop with God. He is the ultimate reality. Asking who created him is meaningless because he was uncreated. For many of my atheist friends, ultimate reality is the multiverse or the universe or mass energy or something like that. So the question is not, is there an ultimate reality? The real question is, which reality is ultimate? So there are several ways we could go now. And one of them I'm just going to mention briefly because it's important, is the Bible has been claiming for centuries that there was a beginning. Now, I'm old enough to remember in the 1960s when the evidence, the first evidence, microwave background by Penzias and so on, expansion of the universe, all that stuff started to come in, and people were getting really excited that science was pointing to a beginning to space-time. What many people have forgotten is it was fiercely resisted by the British scientific establishment. John Maddox, the editor of Nature, said you can't go down that way because it will give too much leverage to people who believe the Bible. One of the biggest scientific cosmological advances of the 20th century was fiercely resisted because it converged with Scripture. Now, that's a very interesting thing. And, of course, there are all kinds of arguments, and I've written about them in my book, God and Stephen Hawking. But I was speaking to Alexander Vilenkin not long ago, who's one of the world's most famous cosmologists, and he pointed me to one of his papers with Alan Guth. It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning, and that is multiverse notwithstanding. Now, this is utterly fascinating to me because it creates an immense problem. If space-time had a beginning, then there was nothing before that. So how are you going to get a universe from nothing? Christians have no problem because there wasn't nothing before that. There was God. God is not physical. God is spirit. And God caused the universe to be. But now let's wear an atheist hat, as I try to do most of the time, and come to see how contemporary cosmologists are wrestling with answering Leibniz's question, why is there something rather than nothing? Let's listen to Hawking. And this is the second classroom argument in God is Not Dead. Professor Radisson, Kevin Sorbo, in that film, pulls out of his pocket a statement by Stephen Hawking and challenges the young student who's never heard it before and is temporarily embarrassed until he sorts it out. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will generate itself from nothing. I saw a preview of the book, The Grand Design, by Hawking and Mladenov, and I was asked to comment on it. And I saw this sentence, and I thought, pardon? Let's look at it again. Because there is a law of gravity, because there is something, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. That's a flat contradiction. I was staggered to find that, so I read it again. I thought, this is not possible. I discovered later, of course, that Hawking says at the beginning of the book that philosophy is dead. And then he writes a book on philosophy. So it's not a bit surprising that something goes very seriously wrong. But it's even more interesting than that. Because there is a law of gravity, it doesn't say because gravity exists. But what would a law of gravity mean if gravity doesn't exist? And what's underneath that is the belief shared by some of my colleagues that laws are creative. Peter Atkins, the physical chemist at Oxford, after a debate once, I said to him, Peter, what do you think created the universe? And he said, mathematics. And I started to laugh, and it was just, I couldn't help it. And he said, what are you laughing at? Well, I said, Peter, I happen to be a mathematician, and that's one of the most idiotic things I've ever heard. He said, what do you mean? Well, I said, Peter, 1 + 1 = 2. Did I ever put $2 in your pocket? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you all suffered from the financial crisis. Do you know why that happened? Because a lot of people thought mathematics could create money. It's called creative accounting. C.S. Lewis saw it long ago. If you've got $1 and you've got another dollar, you can add them and get $2. But first get your dollars first. Mathematics won't create them. And yet people as eminent as Paul Davis suggest this, that laws will somehow create. It's very important to grasp the limitations here. Newton's laws of motion, for instance, have never caused, created, moved anything. Hasn't moved a billiard ball in the history of the universe. People with a Q do that. Not the laws. It's a failure to understand law. And the very interesting thing is this. The very first law that Hawking mentions in his book is the law that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Well, that's a perfectly reasonable law. But please notice it doesn't create the sun or the east or the west. It simply describes what's happening if those things already exist. Oh, but it's even worse than that. The universe will create itself. If I say to you X creates Y, what does that mean? If you've got X, you get Y. If I say X creates X, what does that mean? If you've got X, you get X. And what does that mean? That nonsense remains nonsense even if scientists talk it. And that was quoted in God Is Not Dead film as well. The attempt to make something into nothing is almost comical. Let me quote Lawrence Krauss. See what you make of this. Because something is physical, nothing must be physical, especially if it's defined as the absence of something. What? That is sheer nonsense. And it appears in his book, A Universe from Nothing. They are desperate to get a universe from nothing. So desperate is that they're now redefining nothing. I do a lot of lectures on nothing these days. I'm quite enjoying it. Get a universe from nothing. And I had the opportunity at the Harvard MIT Faculty Club. I took the opportunity. I was debating Alan Guth, who's the world's leading cosmologist. And I said, Alan, I really am dying to ask you a question in public. He said, what's that? I said, you cosmologists are constantly talking about nothing, you physicists. But you don't mean nothing in the ordinary sense of the word absence of anything. And he said, we certainly don't. I said, thank you very much. So I've got it from the very top. And yet, the desperation to get something from nothing is such that people are simply writing absurdity. It's got nothing to do with science. It's just sheer absurdity. Too much ado about nothing. Let me quote you G.K. Chesterton. This is lovely. I really like this. It is absurd to complain that it is unthinkable for an unthinkable God to make everything out of nothing and then to pretend that it is more thinkable that nothing should turn itself into everything. Now, I want to finish by raising a number of other questions. Because the other angle which we have to take in this is related to the who created the creator argument. It's this. God cannot be an explanation at any level because he contradicts the definition of explanation as always proceeding from the simple to the complex. In other words, what we're dealing now with, the question of reductionism. Everything can in the end be reduced to physics and chemistry. Now this is very powerful. And I'm going to illustrate it by a very brief story from my college, because I found myself sitting at dinner one night with a world-famous biochemist, and he was very cross sitting beside me. He discovered I believed in God, and he said, I'm an atheist, I'm a reductionist, we're going to have a miserable evening with nothing to talk about. And I was seated beside him, and I couldn't move. So I said, we're going to have a great chat. He said, are we? I said, yes, because reductionism. I'm a reductionist. a methodological reductionist. If I've got a big problem, I split it into little problems. I study them, try and get insight in the big problem. He said, I do that too. I said, good, we can talk about that, can't we? But he said, I don't mean that. No, I said, you're an ontological reductionist. You believe that everything reduces to physics and chemistry. He said, that's right. So I said, why don't we do an experiment? He said, what, at the dinner table? I said, yes, this is Oxford. So I picked up the menu. It said roast chicken. He said, what's the problem? I said, have a look at it. R-O-A-S-T. I said, those are marks on paper. They're semiotic. They carry meaning. You understand them. Now, you're a reductionist. Yes, he said. Okay, I said, have a go at this. Explain to me the meaning, the semiotics of the marks in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. And his wife was beside him, and rather too loudly, she said, get out of that if you can. But you know, he was such an honest chap, his answer stunned me. He said, John, for the past 40 years, I've gone into my lab in Oxford thinking that could be done. But it so obviously can't. You need an intelligence. I nearly said to him, what, an intelligence of the gaps? No, but the point, he said, is you cannot. It's not within the explanatory power of physics and chemistry to cope with semiotics. And he looked at me for a long time, and I could see it was dawning on him that I wasn't clever enough to have thought of the idea in the first place. So he said, I said, it's okay. I got this from a Nobel Prize winner. Oh, he said, that's okay. I'm relieved. Isn't it interesting, ladies and gentlemen? He saw roast chicken on a menu. And he instantly perceives, that's our word from Roman 1, that it's not within the explanatory power of physics and chemistry. And yet my colleagues in Oxford can look at the 3.5 billion letter word that is the human genome and has a semiotic dimension and ascribe it to chance and the laws of nature alone. That's very odd, isn't it? There's something very odd going on there. Well, of course there is, because if you're a materialist, that's what you've got to say. There's no alternative, and yet your intuition and your instinct at the lowest level of a few letters, roast, tells you that intelligence is involved, no matter how many automatic processes are behind the production of the paper and ink, it has got intelligence stamped all over it. And that, of course, seems to me to be enormously important. And brings me to the final point I wish to make. And that is that we're in the information age. Dawkins concedes it. What lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, not a spark of life. It is information. Life is digital information. Matt Ridley. And the fascinating thing about information, of course, is it's not material. The irony of contemporary physics is that people have come to the conclusion that information is an irreducible quantity, not reducible to mass and energy, and it's not material. Its carriers are material. But information itself is immaterial. And that seems to me, if we were honest, would spell the end of materialism, full stop. You cannot exist with immaterial information and claim that the material can generate it, because they're not even in the same category. Now, this demands enormous exploration, and it interests me greatly because it comes nearer and nearer to my own subject of mathematics. You see, there's a mathematical genius in this country called Gregory Chaitin, who works at the Bell Labs. And he works in information, and to cut a long story short, and I've written about this, he says that any computational device whatsoever, past, present, or future, can be simulated by an abstract thing called a Turing machine. And his work makes plausible, and if you're not interested in this, just go to sleep for 2 minutes. His work makes plausible the idea that no Turing machine, now listen to this, this is something that will simulate any possible past, present, or future information processor, including a human living cell. His work makes plausible the idea that no Turing machine can generate any information that does not either belong to its input or its own informational structure. And that would seem to imply that no molecular device is capable of generating any information that does not belong to its input or its own informational structure. Years ago, earlier than this, Léon Brillouin, in his classic work on information theory, said, "A machine does not create any new information, but it performs a very valuable transformation of known information." Now, this is not God of the gaps thinking. This is information theoretic thinking. And it's arguing, if you look at the cell, it is at least an information processor. And if these things from theoretical computer science have any relevance at all, and they do appear to have, again, it's pointing towards the fact that the living cell with its coding and its information processing is bearing very strong evidence of an intelligent input from the outside. There's a lot of work remains to be done, of course, and I would love to see a lot of it being done. But I want to close by just raising what I think now is the profoundest question of all. We're going to talk in this conference a great deal about science. So before we forget about it, I want to talk about the mind that does the science. What about that? It's very easy to forget it. C.S. Lewis, who I used to listen to in his last lectures at Cambridge many years ago, he placed a very high value on logic and reason. And it was his analysis of the nature of thought, his thinking about thinking, that undermined his own atheism and eventually led to his most powerful repudiation of it. And here, I think, he delivers the fatal blow to naturalism, the atheistic view that nature is all that exists and that mind has been produced by mindless, unguided processes. Ironically, it all goes back, in a way, to what's called Darwin's doubt. Charles Darwin wrote, "But then with me the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind?" And Lewis grasped the implications of that idea. And he wrote, "Unless human reasoning is valid, no science can be true. It follows that no account of the universe can be true unless that account leaves it possible for a thinking to be a real insight. A theory that explained everything else in the whole universe, but which made it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid, would be utterly out of court. For that theory would itself have been reached by thinking, and if thinking is not valid, that theory would of course be itself demolished. It would have destroyed its own credentials. It would be an argument which proved that no argument was sound, a proof that there are no such things as proof, which is nonsense." That Darwin's doubt is very much alive today. John Gray, atheist, professor of the history of European thought at London University, wrote this: "Modern humanism is the faith that through science humankind can know the truth and so be free." Now listen to this. This is an atheist writer. "But if Darwin's theory of natural selection is true, this is impossible. The human mind serves evolutionary success, not truth." Alvin Plantinga, one of the world's leading philosophers, a Christian, sums it up this way: "If Dawkins is right, that we are the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then he has given us strong reason to doubt the reliability of human cognitive faculties, and therefore inevitably to doubt the validity of any belief that they produce, including Dawkins' own science and his atheism." Now listen to this: "His biology and his belief in naturalism would therefore appear to be at war with each other in a conflict that has nothing at all to do with God." That's strong talk, but it's eclipsed by Thomas Nagel, an eminent American philosopher who published a book a year or so ago with an explosive title, Mind and Cosmos. Well, that's pretty innocuous, but it's the subtitle. Why the materialist neo-Darwinian conception of the world is almost certainly false. You look up cyberspace to see what that's done. You see, Nagel is an atheist. He wrote an essay called Evolutionary Naturalism and the Fear of Religion. And he said this, I want atheism to be true. And I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope I'm right in my belief. It is I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. And yet, with utter intellectual honesty, he writes this. Consciousness is the most conspicuous obstacle to a comprehensive naturalism that relies only on the resources of physical science. If we take this problem seriously and follow out its implications, it threatens to unravel the entire naturalistic worldview. If the mental is not itself merely physical, it cannot be fully explained by physical science. Evolutionary naturalism implies that we shouldn't take any of our convictions seriously, including the scientific world picture on which evolutionary naturalism itself depends. I regard this book as of extreme importance because it's coming from a very courageous source, a self-confessed atheist who's analyzing the nature of thinking. And the conclusion, of course, is this, that naturalism is fatally flawed. It undermines the foundations of the very rationality that's needed to construct or understand or believe in any kind of argument whatsoever, including those that are used to defend naturalism. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, the God hypothesis makes sense. But naturalism, it doesn't simply shoot itself in the foot. It shoots itself in the brain. Thank you very much.
That was great. Thank you. I'm speechless. What we'd like to do now is provide an opportunity for you in the audience to ask Dr. Lennox a question or two. And we'll be putting mics in the two side aisles. And you can go to the mic and stand there to be recognized. Dr. Lennox will call on you, and then you can ask your question. And he's got a system that works well that he's used in the past of accumulating several questions and wrapping them into a more coherent response. So he won't answer your question immediately, but he will get to it. So if you have any questions, please feel free to approach the microphones.
And the point is, ladies and gentlemen, that I know in an audience like this, everybody's interested in everybody else's question. That's the first thing. Secondly, the spectrum of questions will determine where we go and in what order. So what I want you to do is give you the opportunity to ask your question, keep it brief because the time you use will be time taken away from the next person. It's not a time for speeches, it's a time for questions. And I write down half a dozen or so, depending on how many come, and then we'll have a go at answering them. Okay, number one. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, C.S. Lewis was an atheist who came to the Lord.
Sorry, I can't
hear you. C.S. Lewis was an atheist who came to know the Lord based on the kind of apologetic arguments that we make. How come so many atheists, including the ones we quote, who come to the conclusion that naturalism is challenged, why aren't they accepting Jesus and becoming Christians? What is the block and what can we do about it? I want to see them come to the Lord.
Thank you. Number two?
So you'd referenced Plantinga's evolutionary argument against naturalism. And it's interesting that I don't...
You'll have to start again.
Okay, let me get a little closer.
And go slowly.
Oh, slow down. I thought we were trying to go fast, so I was going to auctioneer that one. You mentioned Plantica's evolutionary argument against naturalism. And I find that when people hear a description of that argument, they often treat it almost like an Anselmian ontological argument, that it seems tricky somewhere and not very persuasive. When I do ask people about why they don't find it that committing yourself to naturalism provides epistemic undermining to the belief itself, they usually say, well, I think that that truth actually is conducive to natural selection, so our cognitive faculties really will be pointing towards the truth, not because they were designed to do that, but because it just facilitates it, so that they will, as you termed it, end up producing valid belief-forming mechanisms.
Okay, thank you.
And just as a kind of flip side that, because you talked about flipping the argument, I'm assuming then that when you say that a God position does produce valid, trustworthy, belief-forming mechanisms, is that along the lines of also Plantinga's argument with cognitive faculties developed by a designer who points them towards truth? Or do you have another response to that if you're asking why should believers find their cognitive faculties so trustworthy if naturalists shouldn't? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Three? Bend the mic down for him a bit.
Thank you.
That's good. Now we can hear you.
Dr. Lennox, what is your reaction to the recent banning of the teaching of creationism in the British free schools, even the banning of it being taught as a theory?
In British schools, did you say?
In the British free schools. Oh. We would call them charter schools here in America.
Okay. Four. Lady, please.
This goes back to the first question as to why some of the people that are rejecting naturalism aren't embracing Christianity. And I just finished reading your book, and in the last chapter you address the question of miracles, in particular the resurrection. And to me that seems like we really need to, as Christians, understand more about the evidence for that, because I believe that that's really the crux of why someone would choose Christianity and the God of the Bible as the solution if they've rejected naturalism.
Thank you very much. Sir?
What's your argument against the multiverse?
Against?
Against the multiverse.
The multiverses. Okay, yes?
How do you define matter?
How do I define it? And what's the point of the question?
The point of the question is it power that comes from God? Or is there truly matter as we have thought of it for so long? That is, that it exists and will always exist. The matter itself will exist. I don't know, sir.
Oh, well, that's gratifying. Okay.
I'm a simple man.
For you, seven.
Sorry, not a question, but I thought in case nobody or other people don't subscribe to the Smithsonian, this month's Smithsonian has a statement in it: the emergence of intelligence remains a mystery.
Yes, thank you. Right, we have space for one more, two more. You?
My question is, given that you can deduce the existence of an intelligent power, what makes theism a more reasonable position than deism?
What makes theism a more reasonable position than deism? Okay, and the final question I think this must be.
Is it appropriate for science to use methodological naturalism as an irrefutable proposition, and particularly in the area of origin science.
Is it appropriate for science to use methodological naturalism
as an irrefutable proposition, and particularly in the area of
origin science? Okay, thank you very much. See, if I keep going like this, I can then just wait till the time's up and run away. Thank you very much for these questions. They always interest me greatly. Now, this is a Q&A, so what you're going to find out now is my ignorance. You're going to explore that with me. But all I can do in this kind of situation, some of these questions would require lecture, and you can't have a lecture. But what we can do is begin to explore ways in. So it's going to be, by definition, inadequate, but that's a good thing. Because, of course, if you've asked the question, you're interested in it. And the most important work you'll do in those questions is the work you do yourself and come to conclusions. So don't be disappointed if you don't get the big answer from me that's overwhelming. It'd be better if you didn't. It'd be better if it drove you to inquire, even if you're dissatisfied with what I say. It would be better if it drove you to inquire until you became convinced. And then you'd be able to articulate it and share it with other people. So those are the limitations. So off we go. C.S. Lewis was an atheist who came to know the Lord. How is it that many atheists don't become Christians? Well, of course, I can't answer that question because it has to be person-specific. And I can't see inside the heart of a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens. And I'm thankful I'm not required to. What I'm required to do is be a faithful witness. I am thankful that many atheists do come. I've had hundreds of letters and responses to my debates of people who've become Christians through watching them. So I'm not dispirited. I'm a realist. I don't expect to debate a Hitchens and see him converted on the stage. Although I do remember there was a chap called Saul of Tarsus. And I think it's very important to pray for these people and take it seriously. So there are so many reasons because, of course, the business of becoming a Christian doesn't simply involve a conversion at the level of your understanding of science. It involves a conversion at the level of your understanding of ethics and morality. It's got a moral dimension. Listen to Nagel. I don't want there to be a God. That's not a scientific issue. You see? So it's very important to realize that. But I wouldn't dream of second-guessing people. But I tell you, I've got a lot of sympathy for the atheists. If you were Christopher Hitchens and were called to identify the body of your mother when you were 21, who'd entered a suicide pact with a defrocked priest, what would you think of Christianity? We need to realize behind everybody there's a story. And a friend of mine who runs Fixed Point Foundation in Birmingham, Alabama, and you ought to look up his website, decided to write to dozens of young atheists who led atheist groups in university in North America. And he said, I want to hear your story. I'm not going to tell you my story. I want to hear your story, and I'll give you a free meal. He's writing a book about it now. It hit the headlines in The Atlantic, which is a secular magazine, as you know. Because every single one of those young people had a Christian upbringing. And it was negative experience of the church, of parental autocracy sometimes, and so on, that had driven them to atheism. We're going to lose a generation if we don't reverse that, but I'm not going to preach you a sermon. I'm going to go to the next question. Plantinga's argument, I find it very persuasive, and I'm increasingly finding people finding it persuasive, but I think they find it even more persuasive when it's coming out of the mouth of Thomas Nagel. That's simply because Plantinga is a Christian and Nagel isn't. I asked my colleagues in Oxford what they thought of Plantinga. They said one of the world's top philosophers without hesitation. That's independent of his Christianity. And of course we can argue that natural selection has a relationship to truth, but the trouble is if There is no rationality behind nature. You've got no concept of truth even to talk about. That's my difficulty. It's much more fundamental than the way in which you formulated the question. I don't think we have any concept of truth. Concepts of truth and rationality and so on depend on there being an intelligence, some transcendence involved in the universe. Now, that's a huge topic, and I won't answer it adequately, but I'll come to the flip side of it, as you suggested. What about the God hypothesis, believing in God? Why does that make sense and help? Well, look at the rise of science, where I started. You see, it was that belief. If you are a scientist, you have a credo. And the first item in it is you believe science can be done. If you refine that, you believe that the universe is at least in part rationally intelligible, accessible to the human intellect. Why would you believe that? The naturalistic argument that tells you in the end that an unguided natural process is responsible for the mind that's doing the thinking makes no sense. The idea that you can do science because the mind you're doing it with is ultimately traceable to an intelligent God, as is the external universe you're studying, that makes sense. And I would much prefer to have an argument that makes sense than one that doesn't make sense. And I mean that quite seriously. I think the truth criterion of coherence is a very important one to apply, as well as the truth criterion of correspondence to objective reality. So it seems to me that the Christian hypothesis vindicates itself not simply logically, but historically. And if you argue, as I think Dawkins did with me on one occasion, so I better say it in case you found out about it, he said, but that's ridiculous. Everybody believed in God in Europe. Everybody believed in God in those times. I said, yes, in Europe they did, Richard. But China is a very big country. And modern science, as we know it, abstract science, did not develop in China. And the reason we know about that is the work of the sinologist Joseph Needham, who was a scientist, a chemist at Cambridge. And he was a neo-Marxist, and he tried to explain the lack of rise of modern science in China on the basis of his Marxist principles, and he couldn't do it. And in the end, he honestly said, I can see that the only real difference is the Chinese lacked the concept of a single creator who created the universe to run on rational laws. So that's the flip side of that. So that's all I've got time to say about that. What is your reaction to the banning of creationism? Now, that's a huge topic and may be addressed later, because first of all, we'd have to define what we meant by creationism. When I was a student at Cambridge, a creationist was a person who believed in a creator, full stop. No comment on when it happened, how it happened, simply believed in a creator. Now it means a person who has a particular interpretation of Genesis 1. Now, the fact is that that is something that goes on in the world today. So in any intellectually respectable establishment, I would expect there to be taught different perspectives and teach people to think about them. And of course, if you ban something just like that, you're likely to precipitate the very opposite of what you want. I'm really concerned, of course, in our British society for the political correctness that stops people discussing the big ideas that have been running on through history. And that is, creationism is a narrower question about origins. But the big questions about origins, do they involve intelligence or do they not? In some circles, you don't suggest as an intellectual that intelligence is involved. That's banned. But for the vast amount of human intellectual history, that was the majority view. So I'm not going to go into that in detail, because I expect other people are going to approach this topic, and it wasn't part of my lecture. So what about the multiverse? Well, I see Jeff Spheering sitting down there. You go and listen to him if you want to know about the multiverse, because he's written a book about it, and he's doing a breakout session on it. I can't enter it, but the point I was making earlier, it was just a little side remark. What you find around today is there are Christians who believe in the multiverse, and people and Christians who don't. And of course, from a logical point of view, God can create as many universes as he likes. I mean, Max Tegmark of Princeton said there's either a God or a multiverse, but his logic failed. It's the same thing, and let me use it to illustrate what's been going on throughout all this lecture. I've been setting up some of the problems that arise when people set up false alternatives. God or science, a multiverse or God, and so on and so forth. They're false alternatives. Incidentally, when you read the New Testament, there is a bit of a hint that this isn't the only universe, isn't there? So maybe you ought to think about it, but I leave it to you, Jeff, because you'll talk a lot more sense. I'm biased, you see, ladies and gentlemen. I was taught quantum physics by John Polkinghorne, and he's very skeptical about multiverses. So, there we are. I've written a little bit, I've dared to, in my book, God and Stephen Hawking. How do you define matter? Well, any ultimate thing is very difficult to define. We don't know what time is. We don't know what energy is. And do we really know what matter is? The answer is no. We can have various ideas. We talk about the mass-energy conversion and all this, but since if matter is energy, if mass is energy and we don't know what energy is, I suspect we don't know what mass is or matter either. Do you know, it's very important that we realize when people push back on us and we can't explain the big things, that we realize there are many things in science that we can't explain. What time do I have to finish? Oh, it says 1:55 there. Oh, we've got an hour and 52 minutes. Wonderful. The emergence of intelligence is a mystery. Of course it is, in the sense that we've got nowhere scientifically with consciousness. We've got nowhere with intelligence, but I love the word emergence. It's such a multi-pronged, misleading word. Emergence in what sense? Emergence by the addition of energy? Emergence by the addition of an informational input? Emergence how? You need to ask that question. And what assumptions are you applying? Now, somebody referred to methodological naturalism. That is the idea that you should treat the natural world as naturalistically produced. But it's very ironic, and forgive me if I do this a little bit humorously, but it seems to me that methodological naturalism, treating a thing as if it's apparently designed, is only a hair's breadth from methodological theism, treating it as if it's actually designed. The problem comes this way. Of course, you can do as much science you like, assuming naturalistic principles. But the problem comes when doing the science based on those principles, they seem to point beyond themselves. They run out of explanatory power. Are you then allowed to say, well, perhaps if we added intelligence, it would make more sense? So I do not find methodological naturalism a helpful concept, and nor do many of my friends who differ with me actually on many of these things. So let me come to an end. The question from the lady over there in miracles is vastly important. And really, I included it in my lecture about 20 minutes after the end of the lecture. It was about to arrive. Because when we discuss science and belief in God, and I'm going to do this very briefly, this question inevitably comes up. But look, Hume, David Hume, Scottish Enlightenment philosopher, argued long ago, convincingly, that miracles are violations of the laws of nature. And therefore, you might as well stop all this stuff. Because what you're claiming, if there's intelligence out there, in the theistic and not the deistic sense, the big difference between theism and deism. Deism says God started it and we're retired. That's not the Christian view. The Christian view is much bigger than that. God started it and continues to uphold it. Some will argue that the word create bears one meaning, cause to exist. Others will argue, like me, that it bears at least two meanings. Cause to begin, that's cause to exist in the first place, and cause to constantly exist in the present. And two things are predicated of Christ. In him were all things created, and in him all things hold together. There are the two things. Now, to argue that theism is superior to deism, I would want to come to Christianity, where the arguments come from a different source. But let me just finish on miracles very rapidly. It's a huge topic, and you're quite right. I've written two chapters in my book, Gunning for God, on this. I've looked at the evidence for the resurrection through the eyes of David Hume. and used his arguments and then his criteria for witnesses to try and analyze it from perhaps a novel and helpful perspective. But the bottom line for me is what Lewis pointed out long ago, that Hume was wrong. Now, I say that advisedly. I got to know Anthony Flew before he died, who was Richard Dawkins' predecessor, in a sense, is the world's most famous atheist. He was the world expert on Hume. And in high old age, he told me in his own home, he said, I was wrong about Hume. And he said, all my books need to be rewritten, and I'll never live to do it, and I regret that. That's tremendous intellectual honesty. Why was Hume wrong? Well, he was wrong at various levels. He talked about miracles being violations of the laws of nature when he didn't believe in cause and effect, so he couldn't even formulate a law of nature. So that's an inconsistency that many people have observed. But I think the most helpful way to approach it that anybody can understand is C.S. Lewis's argument. And it goes like this. I stay in a hotel. I put $100 in my drawer last night. I put $100 in tonight. $200. I wake up tomorrow and they're $50. What do I conclude? That the laws of Missouri have been broken or the laws of arithmetic? The laws of Missouri, of course. But how do I know that? Because I know the laws of arithmetic. They haven't been broken. The laws of arithmetic tell me what normally happens. And because I know that those laws hold, I know that somebody has put their hand in from outside the system. It doesn't break the laws of arithmetic. If I hit a billiard ball across a table, and then somebody just lifts the ball up, he's not breaking any laws. What he's doing is feeding in a new event outside what we may regard as a closed system. And the thing that's at stake here is this universe a closed system of cause and effect or an open system? And I believe it's an open system. And God, who created the universe, built in these laws. And here's the irony. In order to recognize a miracle, you have to know the laws. If you didn't know that dead people don't normally remain dead, you'd never recognize, you wouldn't see any special in the resurrection of Jesus. You have to know the norm in order to recognize that something special has happened. Now, if I were claiming as a Christian that Christ rose from the dead through naturalistic processes going on in the grave 5 minutes before it happened, then that would be breaking the laws. But I don't claim that, nor does the New Testament. It claims that God, from outside the system, injected colossal power. The laws of nature don't say anything about that at all. And so it's very important to see that this idea that miracles violate the laws of nature is extremely misleading, and it's actually, in my view, quite wrong. We know the laws. You need to have a stable, abnormally stable universe whose regularities are recognizable and codifiable in mathematics, if you like, in order to recognize. Finally, Hume was wrong in saying that people in the New Testament days were primitive, they didn't know the laws of nature, and so they believed in miracles. Luke's Gospel, Luke was the only scientist who writes in the New Testament. Do you ever notice how he begins the book? By telling you of a miraculous conception of a boy born to two elderly people. And when Zacharias was accosted in the temple with an angel, so he believed in prayer, he believed in angels, he believed in all that, and he said, you're going to have a child. He didn't believe that. Why was that? Because he knew what any modern gynecologist would have told him. You're too old, old chap. Isn't that right? The knowledge that one gets too old to have children is something that's been known from time immemorial. They knew that, which is why Zacharias refused to believe it. So Luke starts his gospel with this problem. That fascinates me, that Luke was aware in the first century of the heart of the problem of miracles in the 21st. And he argues through how Zacharias became convinced that something had acted from the outside. But I've gone over the time. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.